This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Rules governing the internet and your data are changing. Find out what that means for users and the steps needed to protect browser history and data.
Most people, and especially most representatives who are more in the consumer protection side of things, were very much against this.
You'll hear from ISU School of Communication Assistant Director of Convergent Media, Nate Carpenter, on what's at risk. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner and Alderman Amelia Burgess are in the studio following Monday evening's council meeting. You'll hear about a new downtown task force and a transportation commission. And we remember Ralph Smith. He helped create GLT more than 50 years ago. His memorial service is today. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 9th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Council members created a task force and moved toward creating a new commission during their regular and special session meetings last night. In the studio to talk about both are Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess and Mayor Terry Renner, who joins us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
A question for both of you before we get into the nitty-gritty details of the downtown task force. What's your vision for downtown Bloomington? Mayor Renner?
Well, I think mine's not too terribly secret, but obviously we're searching for an anchor project so that we have a downtown that's more livable, that is a destination. And obviously we've looked at the area right immediately north of the Coliseum, or diagonally from the Coliseum front and center building, so we can take vacant lots and abandoned buildings and turn them into engines of economic growth. We're also acquiring strategic properties that's now become public to help with parking, as well as perhaps future retail, other development as we move forward. And obviously perhaps the area south of the library, where the library might be able to become a southeast anchor for our community. And of course, there's still interest in the warehouse district, but that might need to be downtown 2.0.
And anything to add or any disagreement there?
No disagreement. Pretty much
in line.
Yeah, I think what we're looking for is a vibrant destination, a place that people look forward to going to and spending their time and living there, working there, visiting.
Ward 1 Alderman Jamie Mathey envisioned moving forward in downtown Bloomington could be painful for visitors, people who visit downtown Bloomington, work in downtown Bloomington, own businesses in downtown Bloomington. Here's what some of what he had to say last night at the council meeting.
Want to make sure that we do this in a way where we have a plan for the business owners who are down there, because when we decide to move forward with this, it could potentially mean digging up Center Street or Main Street for 6 or 9 months. And, when Normal did their massive rehab up there, there was a lot of businesses that never reopened after that time period. So I want to make sure that we're very thoughtful and considerate and have a plan to communicate with building owners and business owners and work with them on how they can stay open during this period of time.
That's Ward 1 Alderman Jamie Mathey from last night's council meeting. Amelia, you're chairing this downtown task force. Is this about economic revitalization, infrastructure revitalization, both?
That and more, most likely. So it's important to keep in mind what this task force is going to do and what it is not going to do. What it is not going to do is redo efforts that have already been done. So we have master plans in place. We have recommendations for what downtown needs to be truly successful, fully revitalized, and an asset not only to our community but to the region. So really the task force is looking at what are those recommendations? What can we do now? What can we do in the midterm, and what can we do in the long term to accomplish all of that? So it's really more about strategy rather than reinventing what's already been done.
Strategy and priorities, it sounds like.
And just to clarify, I think one of the things Jamie was concerned about is to make sure that we take the downtown revitalization plan, the community development plan, all of our other capital improvement plans, and talk about what those next steps are. or might be. The one thing that I would note, when Uptown was being constructed, it was a different type of situation, right? You had abandoned buildings and vacant lots, an EPA Superfund waste site, and
buildings,
now it's an
and buildings that were not historically significant.
Which were not historically significant, right? We already have most of the bones in place, so it doesn't mean we are not going to have sewer issues. We will. We're going to have other kinds of issues, but they're not going to be a situation. I doubt that we're going to have Main Street tore up for 9 months. It's not as if we're going to be replacing a vacant lot with a Marriott. So I think those are some of the things to keep in mind.
The task force reports back at the end of August and submits a final report before the end of the year. Terry, what are you expecting back from this task force?
Well, I think this is a blue ribbon task force. When we sat down, we came up with 9 names, and everybody, our first choices, all said yes. And so I think they're going to be able to hit the ground running. It's a combination of wide variety of people and stakeholders, 3 aldermen. And so these are very, very creative people that I think will give us many options, and they're all problem solvers. We have a vision. We need to figure out how we make that happen. So I think it's one of those tire hits the road things. So we're going to get, by August 31st approximately, an initial preliminary report, what the progress of the committee has made, and then possibly a final report by the end of the year. It may be that this task force continues. And there are many communities that have a permanent commission on the downtown. In the short run, the task here and the charge here, it's a bit more narrow.
I just wonder, Amelia, if you actually need that much time to look at the plans that are available and then prioritize the objectives in those plans. Do you anticipate maybe that there's a possibility that some of the work could be done early of this task force?
Yes, that's certainly a possibility. I think it's nice to have a reasonable time frame, one we know we can meet. But if we get done more quickly, I don't think anyone will criticize us for doing that.
And is there a particular objective or goal in the plans that you're looking at that you would like to see rise to the surface, or is that something the task force will actually sort of deal with?
I think for the moment it's best to leave that conversation open-ended so that we don't cut off any possibilities. I do intend, though, as part of this task force, to reach out to other aspects of the community that may not be represented directly on the task force.
What's an example of that?
The historic preservation community.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Obviously, that is a huge and core part of our downtown is maintaining those historic properties and enhancing them further. So we'll want to make sure that's taken into account, which of course it is in our different plans. But that would be one aspect of a group that I know that we will intend to and will reach out to.
You called it a downtown anchor. Where does a hotel at this moment stand for downtown Bloomington?
Well, we still are in talks with a variety of people in several different possibilities. I can't talk about the details of those in public, but certainly it's very likely that we'll have an anchor project. And in an anchor project, could be one of many things. It could be several. You could have a library, an expanded library facility, and a park area. It could be a destination. Could be another anchor project. But the one that the private sector has been the most interested in is some sort of hotel conference center right by the Coliseum, and either across the street or in the front and center building, which would then, of course, link the Coliseum to downtown and the Route 66 Visitor Center, which, as I understand, has had well over 100% increase in the number of visitors from this April compared to last April.
And on the other end of downtown, near the BCPA, the city just recently acquired more land. You mentioned this as well.
Absolutely.
How does that come into play? Is that land mentioned in any sort of previous plans at this point?
Well, it's alluded to, absolutely. But right now, we now own it, we will own it shortly, and control it. And so in the short term, at least over the next, throughout the end of the year, there's not likely to be anything constructed on that site, maybe longer. It certainly can be alleviating some of our parking problems. We need big signs up there that say public parking, y'all come. And so as opposed to some of the lots where they seem way too bureaucratic.
And then there's also the land on Main between Walnut and Chestnut. Is anything happening there? And will this be part of also what the downtown task force looks at?
Well, I think the downtown task force can look at that. That's then on the upper end of downtown, and it's absolutely, in Amelia's ward. We are working with Illinois Wesleyan so that we can send out a request for proposals. At this point, it's actually Illinois Wesleyan that needed a little bit more time. So I'm guessing sometime in the next 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, we'll be sending something out.
On any of these, you'll be sending something out in 6 to 8 weeks.
That is information about what we're going to do. I don't know that the RFP will be ready in 6 to 8 weeks, but we'll have an announcement hopefully within 6 to 8 weeks.
All right. And anything else imminent with downtown, either the southeast anchor, which is the library, the southwest anchor, which could be the front and center building, or anything along the front and center?
There's always new things downtown. I was just speaking with a group that wants to revitalize one of the older establishments in the 600 block. And, of course, that's sometimes radioactive. I don't want to say there's no day that goes by that there's not something, but there are very few days, at least business days, that go by where there aren't some issues associated with downtown.
It's not the job of this task force, though, to evaluate a proposal that might come in the door in the next 6 to 8 months.
No, it would not be. That would fall on the economic development staff to see if it fits our parameters, and then it would go to council.
But the task force might have something to say about how that project would be prioritized.
Yeah, I think they could definitely provide some guidance in terms of, is that something that is a high need or a medium level need, or is it really just a low need? And certainly we could, I think the goal of a task force is to really bring in new voices, new ideas, and to make sure all voices are part of the process.
There's been this discussion in the community about looking at and serving the core of the community versus development on the periphery of the community. Will this task force prioritize that kind of development, infill, and historic neighborhoods? Obviously, downtown is historic.
Yes, of course. And I think there's been some conversations on council and some council members raising this idea of the need to really start focusing on the historic core of our city and the portion of our city that has unfortunately been neglected for a long period of time, and the need to get caught up there, not only because it is an area that's been neglected, but also because the capacity there and the opportunities is so large. I mean, we're looking at the downtown area, the density there, in terms of building our tax base. So, you know, just from a very pragmatic point of view, from building our tax base, you know, every dollar we spend there is going to pay back a much higher rate of return than some of our more widely spread out areas.
I'm sorry, Terry, go ahead. Just to say that the it's also not, one doesn't preclude the other. Mm-hmm. Some of our greatest successes over the last 4 years have been outside of downtown, and clearly with helping Ovation reinvent themselves with Hy-Vee, with the establishment Empire Crossing, with the new opening of Green Top Grocery Facility on Constitution Trail. There are a lot of things. Now, obviously, they've gotten successes in downtown as well in terms of wayfinding, the Route 66 Visitor Center, et cetera. So we've got lots of balls to juggle, and we want to leverage our assets for the 21st century, and we're not taking full advantage of those assets. And this particular task force is focusing on our cultural historic core.
This is Sound Ideas. Mayor Renner joins us following Bloomington Council meetings. He's joined this week by Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess, who is instrumental in moving forward on a new commission to examine transportation issues. And before we move forward, let me state that I'm involved in transportation issues in the community as a member of the Connect Transit Board of Trustees and as a board member with the bicycle advocacy group Bike Blono. Council only discussed the commission and would vote on it at a later date. Amelia, this commission would replace the Staff Traffic Advisory Committee, or STAC. Why move in this direction?
Well, the goal here is to really bring our transportation decisions in line with how we make other decisions in the city. So a lot of citizen involvement, the opportunity for input, for oversight, as well as to just, you know, bring it out to allow more people to have an opportunity to communicate. So we're looking here at transparency and public involvement and improving that in this area of the city.
Something you want to add, Terry?
I just want to say, give major, major kudos to the strong leadership that Amelia Burgess has demonstrated on this. She really made this all happen, and it is absolutely probably the last area of major improvement that we can make in openness and transparency in Bloomington. I mean, we're still going to look at other things, but this was a gaping hole, and I'm glad that Alderwoman Burgess stepped up to the plate and filled it.
Well, how did it work before? How wasn't it transparent?
Sure. Under the STAC committee, the Staff Traffic Advisory Committee, it was staff-led, so it was not a citizens commission or board like we use frequently in the city. Council was not involved, and it was not a very satisfactory process for residents. It was an efficient process for the city, but it was not subject to the Open Meetings Act, so these meetings were never publicly announced. Individuals who made requests to STAC didn't know when the meeting would be. They weren't invited to speak. They didn't have the opportunity to advocate for their position other than to fill out the initial request form. And at some point in time, they'd get a letter saying that their request was either granted or denied. So that was not a very satisfactory process for the citizens. Now, when we brought up some of these concerns to the city staff, they did make some changes. But really, with a staff committee there's only so far they can go in terms of transparency and openness. So in order to really open up this process and to bring in a wider viewpoint and more citizen involvement, moving into this direction of a citizens commission, I think is really the way we need to go.
How does transparency and public input make solving some of these transportation problems more efficient, do you think?
Well, one thing we were finding is we'd have things go through STAC or through a staff review process, and then they would come to council. And because we were missing that public the interaction part of it, we would find that council couldn't make a decision. So then it would go back for public hearings or kind of on an ad hoc basis. There was no formalized process. So that in and of itself was very inefficient.
And council, of course, is representing citizens who voted for them in their ward. Right. So you want that input.
Of course. Of course. And sometimes, you know, residents bring a point of view that may be missed by the staff. The staff has an expertise that we rely on and is necessary, but it is focused in specific areas. And I'll give you an example because we've been dealing with traffic speeds in the city and what that should look like. So engineers can tell us how fast cars go. They can tell us how fast, how the safest fast speed for traffic on a road. So how quickly can a car go and safely navigate a road? I mean, they can calculate that and provide us with that information. What an engineer cannot do, because it is a policy decision, is tell us how fast should the traffic go on that street. Because while a car may be able to safely navigate a street at 40 or 45 miles per hour, the magnitude of harm they can cause if there was a collision or an interaction between that car and the pedestrian is much, much higher than if the car is going 30 miles per hour. So as a matter of policy, council may decide that a 45-mile speed limit, even though it is technically safe for the driver, is not a desirable speed for the city. And that's an area where we need to be able to have that kind of public policy conversation.
But we know that speeds really aren't determined by what's posted. It's based on how the road is designed. Could this commission come back and say, you know, we can post the speed limit at 30 miles or 25 miles an hour, but we really need to do some curb bump outs or narrow the lanes? Would this commission get into those kinds of details, perhaps?
Absolutely. They would get into at least that conversation and be a resource and an investigatory resource where they could start bringing in this kind of more creativity, innovation that we're looking for as we try to implement more of these safe and complete streets practices.
Terry, there's something you wanted to add?
I think everything Alderman Burgess has said is absolutely spot on. It'll improve the efficiency and the effectiveness of this. And, you know, obviously she's always much more diplomatic than I am. It was about as closed a process that you could design. So, you know, we don't want a Soviet gulag in Bloomington, right? You know, so we want to have open government. We got an A+ from the Illinois Policy Institute, and this is one area, frankly, that's embarrassing. And I'm glad that Alderman Burgess took the lead on this and made this happen.
Terry, there was some concern about the speed at which this proposal was moving. Ward 2 Alderman David Sage seemed to expect some incremental approaches. What do you both think? And I'll ask Terry first.
Sure. There are different ways that you can move. I think this is hardly something we've moved that rapidly on. This is something I think that Alderman Burgess filled out a form to have this brought forward to the council last summer. The idea would be, I think, I can't put words in Alderman Sage's mouth, but he was looking for some sort of interim changes, and the staff has already provided that. As an alderman, you just got to make a decision at some point. You can't just futz around and study something. If you have something and you've got a reasonable alternative, then implement it. If you need to tweak it later, then do that as well. Again, Bloomington has not had a culture of moving rapidly, but we are beginning to do so.
You are a deliberative body. I will give you that. Amelia, same question about the speed and incremental approaches on this issue.
Sure. And as I mentioned, staff did make some changes to try to address some of these concerns, but they will admit that they've taken it as far as they can go without this next step. And staff supports moving towards a citizens commission at this point in order to really achieve what council's goal is, which is openness and transparency. And I just want to note, while I appreciate Mayor Renner's compliments and credit for this, I'm not the only one working on this. I've been pushing it, but it is with the support of several other aldermen who also have taken this on and believe it's very important. Alderman Black, Schmidt, Painter, just to name a few.
You sort of addressed this a little bit, but I'll dig a little deeper here. Will this be a proactive commission or a reactive commission? For instance, would this commission, in terms of the city's new complete streets ordinance, seek out opportunities to advance those policies? Or would it be along the lines more of fielding citizen complaints and requests and deal with initiatives from staff?
As the proposal currently sits as both, it will be responsive to complaints or requests from residents, but it also is empowered under the language of the proposal to make recommendations, to say to council, this is something you should consider doing, you should change this ordinance, or we should look at speed limits on this street, or we should look at speed limits community-wide, and then they would provide the opportunity to look at that further.
There was a question about a downtown Bloomington Traffic Commission or Transportation Commission. Will that commission be subsumed by this new commission?
No.
It'll be a separate. Will they interact in any way? Do they need to interact?
I would assume at some point. I don't know.
I think they will. Whenever you're creating something new, there are a lot of details to work out, and we'll deal with those going forward. For the moment, they will remain separate. I would anticipate they will inform each other. Eventually, they may be wrapped into one.
Truck routes likely to be dealt with by this commission at some point?
Yeah. So we talked about truck routes a few months ago. Council was interested in looking at that further, but really didn't have a mechanism to do that. This will give us that mechanism to hold public hearings, to discuss it in a public manner, and to get input to figure out if that's something that the community is willing to look at, because council was very interested at the many benefits a truck route could provide.
So more work for you, Terry, because you have to find people to appoint to this commission once council, presuming council, approves it.
I don't think that's going to be a problem.
All right.
I don't usually have that difficulty.
And when will council vote on this proposal?
I think next time.
Yeah, we're looking at 2 weeks. And, with regard to the Citizens Commission, I'm really excited because this allows us to bring in some lay people who have areas of expertise we don't have on our staff. For example, people who have a great deal of experience with accessibility and accommodating disability within transportation. That's an area of expertise we don't specifically hire for in the city right now. So if we can bring in people who have that kind of experience or with pedestrian safety, school routes, et cetera, I'm really excited to see what this commission can bring to us.
Okay, Amelia, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
And Terry, as always, thanks for stopping by on Tuesdays. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess is 2 years into a 4-year term. Terry Renner was sworn in for a second term as mayor earlier this month. The community's mayors join us on Sound Ideas most Tuesdays following their Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Skin Dimensions Day Spa. Their licensed estheticians provide personalized plans for your skincare needs, including facials, peels, microdermabrasion, and more. Skin Dimensions Day Spa at Soderstrom Skin Institute is proud to serve McLean County at 2100 Jacobson Drive in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, find out how you can protect your internet browsing history and data following new rules giving telecom companies access. The interview is on the way during Sound Ideas. This evening, the Stevenson Center for Community and Economic Development will unveil the results of a study it conducted examining inequality in Bloomington Normal. The research was conducted by Illinois State University students for the grassroots organization Not in Our Town. Sociology professor Frank Beck, who supervised the study, stopped by our studios to offer a brief overview of the findings. He tells GLT's Judy Valente that while Bloomington Normal stacks up positively in some areas compared to other Illinois communities, the Twin Cities still needs to take steps to become more inclusive. Researchers looked into whether there are disparities in access to services and in the criminal justice system and sought to provide an overall portrait of life using a variety of measures.
We did that with some census data. We did that with traffic stop data. We did that with jail data with respect to McLean County Jail. We did focus groups, we did interviews, and then we also looked at 20 years of the pantograph and dove into the archives at the museum, all about painting a portrait or holding up a mirror with respect to social issues in Bloomington Normal.
What were you looking for specifically?
We were not looking for problems and only problems. We were not looking for only things that sounded great. The Not in Our Town, their local chapter, they're, figuring out what their next steps are or should be with respect to this community. And this is certainly not a needs assessment. That's not what we did. It is a documentation of across a number of different issues.
What were some of the surprising things that you found in general?
Bloomington Normal has lower levels of segregation relative to other communities in central Illinois, for instance.
Other communities such as?
Urbana-Champaign, Springfield, Decatur, Peoria, Rockford. The measure takes into account what is the racial and ethnic makeup of the city, and how does that compare to the racial and ethnic makeup of each neighborhood? And to the extent that the neighborhoods differ from the city as a whole, that would be a higher level of segregation. But if each neighborhood has numbers, has values that is closer to the distribution of race and ethnicity in the city, then that would mean there's less segregation. So we looked at a number of other issues. We looked at traffic data. We looked at the jail data. We also conducted interviews, focus groups, and the picture, as one would likely expect, is mixed. That there are some things that we can be proud of in the sense of we'd made progress over time, and there's other things that we probably have to work on as a community.
What about traffic stops? Because that is a point of contention, that African Americans are stopped proportionately more frequently, they're searched more frequently.
There are differences between Bloomington and Normal and between those six other cities with respect to traffic stops and with respect to race and ethnicity and those traffic stops. There are differences.
There seems to be in Bloomington Normal a different perception of the community by minority residents than white residents, than majority residents. Did any of your research find that to be true, or find what are some of the underlying causes?
On the qualitative side, the interviews and focus groups, were conducted with community leaders and then with some individual persons. There are patterns in those results with respect to what issues were brought up and how they were brought up, that one could point to them being different by a majority or a minority population. But it's not just race and ethnicity either. You know, disabled persons were part of it, and LGBT persons were part of it. So it's not just a race and ethnic thing. There's a number of different topics that were covered.
I'm thinking back to a Black Lives Matter forum that was held last year in December, and community people spoke about their experience of the community in a way that was totally different, I thought, than a white person would talk about their experience in the community. And there seemed to be this gap between also how the officials viewed the community and viewed the job that they were doing and what people felt. Did you find anything like that?
That is not a surprise. We come to these conversations with our past experiences. And so for one demographic or category within the community, for them to perceive things different from another demographic or category in the community, that is not a surprise at all. We did not specifically ask those kinds of questions with respect to how people perceive the community.
What do you think has to improve just in general from your research? Where can we do better?
I think over time, Bloomington Normal has done a remarkable job of talking about these issues. That does not mean that we are perfect or that we are better than other places. This study, the activities of Not in Our Town, the activities of Black Lives Matter, other organizations in the community, all contribute to taking steps forward in a positive way to make this a more inclusive, welcoming place to persons of all ethnicities, all minority, all levels of disability. The fact that these organizations exist and are acting, including this project, is evidence that we are moving in a good direction.
What do you hope will happen as a result of this study, releasing the findings of the study?
The number one goal is that the Not in Our Town people will be able to take the findings and the report and figure out what they want to do as an entity, as an organization within this community. Whatever that means for them in terms of moving the community forward, that's what I hope our study contributes to.
We've been talking with Dr. Frank Beck. He is a professor of sociology at Illinois State, and he is talking about a recent study that his students have done under his direction, looking at issues of race and tolerance, of segregation and integration in the Twin Cities. Thanks a lot, Dr. Beck.
Thank you, Judy.
I'm Judy Valente.
Stevenson Center's full report on inequality will be released tonight. The report was compiled by 15 ISU seniors from the sociology department, 12 graduate students in the community, and economic development. It's Sound Ideas. One of the founding spirits of WGLT has died. Ralph Smith was 95 years old. Services are today at First United Methodist Church in Normal. Before there was a GLT, there was a campus radio program at Illinois State that grew out of a short daily segment made available to the campus through a local commercial station. The man who envisioned an educational broadcast station out of those humble beginnings lived in the Twin Cities. WGLT's Willis Kern has more in this rebroadcast of an interview done last year for GLT's 50th anniversary.
I visited with Dr. Ralph Smith at his apartment in Bloomington's Westminster Village just days after he and his wife Ellen celebrated their 70th wedding anniversary. Now 94 years old, Smith still sports the same wavy crop of white hair he had when I took classes from him at ISU in the 1970s. Smith says he arrived on campus in the late 50s to expand 15 minutes a day of programming on WJBC to a closed-circuit radio and TV system for ISU.
My basic job, I was really on the fringes of what was then the speech department. I was a member, but I really reported to a committee that was not connected with the speech department, because my job was to get the campus wired up with television, set up a studio, and begin to work with College of Education, which wanted to have observations, particularly of special ed kids. They could do an observation pickup in the studio and send it out to the appropriate classes.
The TV system was in essence a forerunner of what became the TV 10 program, and the radio part eventually became the closed-circuit student-run WILN, which in the 80s became WCND. Smith says thoughts of WGLT began circulating in his mind in the early to mid-60s.
About 1964, we really began seriously to consider going on the air with a regular university station. And I think we talked about low power and maybe graduating to higher power, and deciding that there would really be only one person hired, and that would be a manager for an on-the-air station. We had the staff of technicians who could keep it running. I can remember going through paperwork from the FCC and reading about broadcasting.
And what about the name WGLT? Was there a lot of debate about what the station should be called?
We had a contest. Anybody could turn in what would be a good call letter for our station. And some student, I forget who he was, and we offered to give them three long play disc records at the time. So he won WGLT. We gladly learn and teach, which was the motto of the university. It was a perfect set of call letters at the time. Of course, it had, when that motto came into being, it was only a teacher's college.
What do you think of how WGLT has evolved into just what it is now, GLT?
To me, the WGLT really represents the university in the best way possible. I realize the difficulty of getting people to tune in to a public station. It's just not part of our culture. I can recall shortly after President Johnson created National Public Radio that he was out of office and Nixon was the first president. He didn't even include public radio and television in his first budget. Congress got that money in there. And they've had, of course, they've had a struggle ever since trying to finance the whole national system properly.
Dr. Ralph Smith, whose vision for radio at ISU eventually led to WGLT's sign-on in 1966. Smith retired from ISU in 1985. I'm Willis Kern.
Ralph Smith was also a civil rights worker who went on to Mississippi the year of Selma and later told friends he wasn't sure he would come back. Smith was tossed out of a whites-only Methodist church in the South for trying to integrate it. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Rules that would have provided greater protection over your browsing history and other internet data have been overturned. Congress passed the bill, overturning the rules, and President Trump quickly signed the bill in early April. The rules would have provided consumers more control over what their internet service provider can do with the data. In the studio is Nate Carpenter. He's the Assistant Director of Media Convergence with Illinois State University School of Communication and runs the Social Media Analytics Command Center, or SMAC. Nate, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thank you very much for having me.
How concerned should we be?
It depends on who you are. If you are a consumer that really likes convenience and you like having a lot of personalized advertising and you don't mind that, this really doesn't affect you all that much. If you are a person, however, who really likes to have more control over who gets to see what that you post and view and say online, this should be very disconcerting.
Opposition to the rules that would have protected consumers was led by GOP members of Congress and the telecom industry. They contend the FCC rules presented an unlevel playing field since Google and Facebook were already collecting consumer information for data-driven ads. What is Facebook and Google doing?
So Facebook, for example, they're actually a fairly closed system. I mean, you have to log into Facebook, and you have to explicitly give Facebook a number of permissions to use and to work with your data in different ways.
Permissions people may or may not be paying close attention to.
That's completely accurate, yep. And in most cases, people are unaware that many of the default settings, in fact, are to provide a lot of your data to Facebook. Some of that may not be personal in your middle name and all of your family members. But it may include things like the things that you like on a page. It may include hobbies and interests that you actively post. So in many cases, people are I wouldn't say tricked, but they are not fully cognizant of that which they are giving away in these
spaces.
Somehow
I get a lot of ads for bicycle gear.
I can't imagine why that would be.
Why would that be? And then Google's doing something similar?
Google does something very similar. I think the argument about that being an unfair playing field is that most people interface with the web through some sort of Google product that is out there. In most cases, Google is the most popular search engine. So just by virtue of using Google itself, again, people are already leaving traces of their online browsing habits.
What do you expect Comcast and Frontier and other ISPs to do with our data?
Well, they use it to learn things such as when we go online. They are able to see, depending on, again, what kinds of browsers that we're using, they can see which sites we go to during which time of day. They can get a sense of which kinds of apps that we're using. So they get a very good sense of when we're using Netflix, for example, based upon the volume of data and bandwidth. And they can use that to figure out when it's better to advertise certain kinds of things. So if we're all going to Netflix at the same time of day, it may be better for certain kinds of ads to be displayed and shared.
Does this to you seem pretty apparent that it was not citizen-driven or constituent-driven? This was driven by bigger companies.
Right. This was very much driven by major telecom companies. most people, and especially most representatives who are more in the consumer protection side of things, were very much against this because there's, again, an obvious you know, gain to be had by these companies and organizations.
So this is a somewhat serious matter, but let's listen to what Stephen Colbert on The Late Show on CBS had to say about this during a recent episode.
Not one voter of any political stripe anywhere in America who asked for this. No one in America stood up at a town hall and said, "Sir, I demand you let somebody else make money off my shameful desires." Yeah.
Nobody.
Maybe blackmail me someday. That. Please, give it to somebody else. No, you can't imagine anybody asked this to happen.
No.
I can't believe they're publicly taking the side of big internet cable companies. Taking the side of a cable company, the only thing less popular would be if they passed a bill allowing traffic jams to call you during dinner to give you gonorrhea. Honey, it's for you.
So, Stephen Colbert on The Late Show on CBS. Have you spoken with anybody who supports this?
I don't know anybody who is actively saying, yes, please, let's you know, give away more data. Yeah.
So, and Colbert took it to, you know, exactly where some people are concerned. Shameful desires is the term he used. When we talk about data, exactly what are we talking about? Everything that we, every place we go, everything we do?
Right, so...
How long we're there?
Yeah, both of those are things that are tracked. But especially that viewing and browsing history. So every internet site that you would go to is something that can be, you know, tracked. There's a record of your computer, you know, going out and shaking hands with the server where a certain website is held. So all of that is collected and duration, everything that you go through and click on, anything that is downloaded, so any transfer of data back and forth. So that could be images, that could be music, that could be you know, any kind of content. I mean, all of that has some sort of record that could be gone back into.
That's Nate Carpenter. He's the Assistant Director of Media Convergence with Illinois State University School of Communication, runs the Social Media Analytics Command Center, or SMAC. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. So we can't protect our data and history. What's the first step? Using the right browser?
That's actually a very easy step to take. Again, there are many different internet browsers available to you. That's how most people, again, access the internet. That's how you view things on the internet. And most people are using common browsers such as Internet Explorer, Google Chrome, Mozilla Firefox. And especially Chrome and Firefox actually have built-in extensions that will do what's called masking or hiding your internet address. And so what that will do is it will basically tell the website that you're visiting that you're actually coming from a different location.
And, so is that something you have to select, or an app you add on to, an extension you add on to those browsers?
Yep, that's precisely it, either an extension or an add-on. And there are a variety of those out there. The only problem, of course, though, is those extensions are built by other people, other companies, and in many cases, their effectiveness is not necessarily guaranteed. So especially if you think about Google.
Or they may be collecting
right,
the data.
They may be collecting the data. And in fact, many of these extensions may collect the data surreptitiously, kind of in a different way. And if you don't read the terms of use or the...
Who does?
Right. And they're hundreds of pages long in some cases. But if you don't, you know, adequately go through and understand everything that these additional apps could collect, you know, by still, you know, claiming to give you a little bit more privacy, you're still giving away something.
So is there a browser to use that you wouldn't have to add on to add those extensions or apps to?
You know, one that has been recommended for at least consumer use is called Opera, and it's just like the musical term. So the Opera browser actually has a VPN built in, and they work with a company. And VPN, by the way, stands for Virtual Private Network. And what that does is it uses the internet and allows you to connect to other computers as though you were on a private network. And so all data that is shared across that network is encrypted. So things like the location you're coming from, the location you're going to, maybe the data that you're transferring, all that's encrypted, which means, again, it's treated in a way that nobody, at least most, you know, companies wouldn't be able to go in and see exactly what you're transferring.
And that's built into Opera.
You have to turn it on. There's a setting in Opera, but once you turn it on, it's active, and it allows you a number of different settings, including you can choose where you want to appear to be coming from, or you can allow it to set that location.
people who are familiar with Firefox or Chrome or Internet Explorer, will they find Opera just as easy to use?
Opera is just as easy to use as these other browsers.
And can you import your previous settings or bookmarks into Opera?
Absolutely. Yep. When you first install, it will ask you whether or not you want to do that.
So are all virtual private networks, VPNs, created equally?
They are not. And VPNs, in fact, are fairly easy for hackers and governments and you know, other agencies wanting to see your habits. It's still fairly easy for them to either hack into them or even to use them surreptitiously, like I just described with other extensions, that they may be able to listen in on that activity. But for general consumers, again, those of us who would rather not to be advertised to, you know, constantly or to have that personal browsing data collected, VPNs are a fairly good way to go. Very simple process. They don't interfere too badly with the speed of your internet connection, and they don't restrict the kinds of things that you can do. Some services will actually restrict your ability to do things like watch video or use Flash or to
Constrict the bandwidth.
Correct.
So I use Chrome. I have an extension. It's a VPN extension. I can select the country by which or through which it's routed, or it'll just randomize it for me. But I don't really know anything about this company. It was recommended by Google, so I kind of went, well, okay, maybe that's okay. Is there any way, other than reading the hundreds of pages of user agreement, to say this is a good option?
Well, reading those pages is important. I'd still recommend that you do that. But another thing that you can do is actually go to organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and go to that website. I think it's just EFF.org and browse their site for recommendations of other extensions to use. They can provide a number of options that they have either tested, that they have people within their organization who are developing those tools, and they can make some very strong recommendations.
Opera works on mobile devices?
That's a good question. I haven't tested it yet.
What about mobile devices? iPads, tablets or cell phones when you're out and about?
Sure. So there are a couple of browsers available that I know of. One that is available is actually called Orfox, and it's been developed by the Tor Project, which is actually a very complex VPN service that does multiple layers of encryption. And in fact, it will bounce your connection around the world to all sorts of different routers and makes that encryption much more strong because it's doing, again, all this different bouncing.
If I'm using the Tor network, does that make me a target for government surveillance? Will someone go, you know, this guy is doing all of his internet browsing using Tor? We should pay attention to him.
It can. In fact, hacks into the NSA and WikiLeaks has revealed, really, that the U.S. government does pay attention to groups and organizations and people who use Tor. But one of the difficulties is they can't always tell what's being shared. They can tell that somebody's using it, and they can tell maybe on the other side with really sophisticated algorithms when or what network they may be connecting to, but they can't see necessarily in between.
And Tor stands for?
The Onion Router.
And how was that, or who developed that?
Certainly. So that was actually developed in the mid-90s by the United States Navy. And it was developed really to protect military communications.
And now in some respects, it's a weapon or being used by people who may want to hide their activities from the government or the Navy who developed it.
Correct. Although not only does it protect military secrets and information, it's also been distributed in countries where there might be a lot of civil unrest, and the United States has an interest in promoting that unrest and revolution. And so it's been, I think during the Arab Spring was a really good example of that router being used to disseminate information and giving people access to the internet without government interference in repressive regimes.
A couple of quick questions about just basic security. Do you want to say anything about passwords?
So, yes, I can say a lot about passwords.
Or the key code I use on my phone, or the design people draw on Android phones to access their device.
Right. There are many competing, I guess, theories about which kinds of passwords work the best. And all in all, the best ones are those that contain no semantic meaning. So no names, numbers should not be really connected to anything, you know, in your life. So like anniversaries and birthdays and you know, years you graduated high school, all those things are fairly easy for someone to go into a social media account and figure those out. Really, the longer the password, the better. The more random the characters, the better. And the hard part, of course, is that we have human memories. It's very hard for us to remember long strings of names and characters. So finding a good mnemonic pattern for yourself is something I've often recommended.
What about securing your home Wi-Fi?
In terms of home Wi-Fi, obviously make sure that you do have a password that is required to log in.
Not the one that was provided to you by the...
Correct, which is usually password or 1111.
Or admin or something
right,
like that.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. You run the Social Media Analytics Command Center. Was the whole thing over the internet rules and Trump signing the bill, was that a source of concern and frustration expressed on social media? Did you see an uptick in conversations about that?
We didn't study it directly in the SMAC. However, my own personal observations, what was very interesting is that this is something that I don't think a lot of everyday people really even looked at or covered. In the kind of the culture that I kind of follow and analyze, which is again, into technology issues and really into internet studies and all that. This was a hot button issue really for weeks. If I was to look at the top thing everyone was talking about, I mean, the week before this bill came up, just after it came up, an immense amount of discussion about how do we get the rest of the world excited about this and concerned about this.
And we joked about it earlier, but it could be that I'm looking up sensitive information about a health concern.
Right, and that's actually a really good example. Let's say you have a condition that you're looking up online. Let's say we all go to WebMD like we tend to do and try to self-diagnose.
Yeah. Am I dying tonight or do I just have indigestion?
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, that kind of search is some of that data that can be collected.
And you can't erase it once it's...
And that could be bought and sold to insurance companies.
And private browsing, just to state this up front, that doesn't do anything here. That just sort of keeps it from going into your own cache.
Correct. Yep. Yeah, private browsing just turns it off so that other people using your computer don't see what you did.
Okay, Nate, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Nate Carpenter is the Assistant Director of Media Convergence and runs the Social Media Analytics Command Center at Illinois State University. I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the interviews and stories heard today thanks to Judy Valente and Willis Kern at WGLT.org. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.